Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Bongartz, who's the Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at Population Council, where he has worked for four decades. He serves as Chairman of the Panel on Population Projections of the National Academy of Sciences at the National Research Council. He is a member of the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Bongartz.
Good to be here.
And today, of course, believe it or not, a lot of the press coverage talks about how the world is celebrating the 7 billionth as a baby that was born, apparently, sometime in the last 24 hours, it's estimated. So why are we celebrating? Or why is that word celebration connected to what would seem to be a fairly clear case of an increase in an already overpopulated planet?
Yeah, the day of 7 billion is a time to reflect on the importance of demographic trends. They're very slow but very powerful, and they affect our lives and the environment. So this is the event is both good news and bad news. The good news is that we have managed to add 4 billion people to the planet in the last 50 years without completely wrecking the planet. And that is in part due to human ingenuity, particularly the Green Revolution, which has made possible to grow much more food and therefore avoid starvation. The bad news is that the planet is beginning to show increasing signs of stress, and I think that will get worse over time. Global warming is an obvious example. Global warming is leading to increases in sea level, to a reduction in agriculture productivity, and in rise in storms and floods. So those will affect particularly poor people in poor countries.
Well, John Bongartz, the UN or demographers say that it took the planet until 1804 to reach its first billion mark, and then a century more until it hit 2 billion in 1927. And then things began to exponentially increase. 3 billion in 1959, 4 billion in 1974, 5 billion in 1987, 6 billion in 1998, and the UN estimates that the world's population will reach 8 billion by 2025 and 10 billion by 2083. So it's obvious that this trend is it's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's getting worse faster.
Yes, the last few decades, population growth has been extraordinarily rapid, and the reason for that is that after World War II, Western technology to conquer infectious diseases was exported to Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which were very poor at the time. We provided antibiotics, vaccines, public health measures, and so on. And the result of that was a very large decline in the death rate. So few people died, but the birth rate stayed very high. And if you have more births than deaths, that means rapid population growth.
Well, nobody's suggesting that those life-saving advantages should not be given to people in the third world, in Africa and Asia. So what is the answer?
The answer is, I think, simpler than people can imagine. We have high birth rates in Africa and other places that cause the high growth rate, but many women bear unplanned children. Actually, 40% of pregnancies in the developing world are unplanned or unwanted. The reason for that is that women who want to stop childbearing often cannot easily get access to contraception. So a simple thing that governments can do, and in fact are doing in some countries already, is to provide contraceptive services and information to women so that they can avoid these pregnancies.
Well, whenever one has these discussions, particularly when two white men talk about population control, a lot of people of color use the word genocide. Even a presidential candidate, Herman Cain, has brought up that notion that being for choice, being in favor of abortion, somehow the equivalent of wanting to commit genocide. So how do you respond to that?
Well, the intention of these programs, family planning programs, is to help women. So imagine you're a poor woman in a rural village in Africa. You've had four or five children, and you don't want any more. Your neighbors are having eight or nine children. What do you do? It's not genocide to help women improve the lives of the children she already has. Families poor, they cannot afford eight, nine children, so they would like to have just four, but there's no simple way to do that because access to contraception is not there. If the woman can control her own family and do what she wants with their reproductive decision, then she benefits because she no longer has the risk of future pregnancies. There are enormous health risks associated with that. It will improve the quality of life for her children, for herself, for her family, and for society. I think that's a win-win situation.
Again, I'm speaking with John Bongartz, who's Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council, where he has worked for four decades. He serves as Chairman of the Panel on Population Projections of the National Academy of Sciences at the National Research Council. And we're talking about the seventh billionth person to be born and add to the world's population. And let's then, when you talk about this woman in a poor rural African village has her seventh child, and her neighbors have eight and nine children, and if she had contraception, she would therefore be able to take better care of those that she already has, who probably aren't doing that well. What is preventing this woman from getting the contraception she needs? You know, getting rid of all of these social arguments that are out there in our politics about abortion, and even the Pope even is against contraception. So we know that there's a political constituency against this. What are the actual political impediments and the economic impediments to get that contraceptive device plus the information to that woman?
Well, as you point out, there are political issues here. In this country, we have certain groups, conservative groups, who oppose family planning and abortion. And in fact, the position seems to be contradictory to me because by providing contraception, you avoid abortion. As I mentioned earlier, there are about 75 million unplanned pregnancies in the world, and about half of those end in abortions. That's 33 million abortions each year, because women did not have access to contraception. So if we provide contraception, we can avoid abortions, which nobody thinks is a great thing, and we can improve the lives of women and children. So it seems a win-win situation all around. And in African countries, conservative forces like the church have a powerful effect on what the governments do. So some countries in Africa have family planning programs where the government has seen that these are beneficial and these countries are better off. Other countries have decided for political and other reasons not to invest in family planning programs, and those countries are often worse off.
Well, why then do churches and religious institutions have the influence they have? I mean, the Catholic Church has been beset by sex scandals involving pedophilia. They paid out billions and billions of dollars. What makes them the global expert on family planning and on people's sexual behavior?
Well, there are many Catholics in the world who follow the Church's preachings. In this case, I think the Church has it wrong. There is nothing, in my view, objectionable to using contraception if it improves the health and well-being of people.
Well, I believe the Pope has somewhat changed his tune on that, hasn't he? He was dead against any form of contraception and went along with that canard that condoms don't prevent AIDS. And I believe, has there been a change of heart there?
Yeah, a little bit, but not in general against contraception, I think. There's still a prohibition against that.
I see.
But the Church might well be changing its mind, which would be, I think, well overdue.
And tell me about the bias against female children that's prevalent in India and other countries, and how much is that affecting the demographics? Because in India has 893 girls for every 1,000 boys, and a lot of that's to do with you know, the forced abortion or even girl children are even killed, as my understanding is.
Yeah, it's that is to some extent true, but mostly it's abortions after the sex of the fetus has been determined. Women have access to abortion, and that's how you end up with the sex ratio. These are societies where, for a very long time, historically, males have been favored over females. These are patriarchal societies, and those values are deeply ingrained in society. So we can address that by improving the lives of women, empowering them, providing them education and access to family planning so they can take charge of their own lives.
And what about China then, John Bongartz, again the Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council, where he's worked for four decades. He also serves as Chairman of the Panel on Population Projections of the National Academy of Sciences at the National Research Council. China, of course, has had birth control, one-child policy now for several decades, and it also has 1.34 billion people, being the world's most populous nation. But it is an authoritarian government. So how do you have, arguably they've been the only country that's been successful in terms of population control. Does that mean that you have to have a kind of authoritarian government to make it work?
No, absolutely not. I think what happened to coercion was a very, very bad policy. It was counterproductive in some ways. And China at the time that they implemented the one-child policy, fertility was already very low, or relatively low. It was just 2.5 children. So you can argue that the one-child policy, in fact, added very little to the trend, downward trend in fertility that was already occurring. If you, at the moment, remove the one-child policy altogether, which I hope the Chinese government will do soon, without the one-child policy now, fertility would not increase very much. So it's a largely irrelevant policy now, and it has done a great deal of damage.
And China also has this skewed sex ratio. Apparently, again, a lot of sex-selective abortions take place to eliminate, to create fewer girls in a population where parents favor boys. Is that some cultural condition?
Yeah, that's exactly the same as in southern India, a preference for boys. And when you're only allowed one or two children, you want to make sure you have at least one boy, and that leads parents to abort female fetuses.
So what is your understanding, John Bongartz, about the way that biologists see the world? Because I remember speaking to a very distinguished biologist who said that the biosphere, this sort of little fragile globe that we all inhabit in the middle of this vast expanse of space, can ideally could support about a billion people in terms of biodiversity. And we know that every day we lose hundreds of species of plants and animals. And eventually, the world is going to be a very different place, I take it, when you have billions more people and billions fewer species of other life forms on the planet. Doesn't that indicate that the human species is a kind of contagion, as, at least from the point of view of other species?
Well, yeah, there's no question that many species have become extinct recently, and that's largely due to human activity. So the question is, how many people can we support? There's really no single answer to that. If we want to keep the environment completely pristine, then we would have to reduce the population of the world, which is, I don't think is going to happen. In fact, I think we'll end up probably close to 10 billion eventually, and that will be very bad for the environment. So global warming will likely continue. Deforestation and the disappearance of species that go with it will continue. Fresh water will be depleted. So we may end up with 10 billion people, but they will live in an environment that is very badly degraded.
So this is singularly the main cause that's driving the degradation of the environment?
No, of course not. It's one dimension. The other dimension, obviously, and in fact in some ways more important, is consumption of resources. So an average American consumes very large amounts of energy and of food. Food, not only the number of calories, but also the meat content. We are very large meat eaters, which require a lot of food to be grown to feed animals, which we then eat. So our ecological footprint of an American is much, much larger than that of the average African or Indian. And the question in the future is not only how many people will there be, but how will they live? I think it's essentially impossible for the whole world to live like we Americans do. So the question is then, how will the rest of the world fare? And the answer is not very well, I suspect. The rich people probably can buy their way into a reasonable standard of living, but the poor will have to put up with the environmental constraints. One example is, the food price increases that have occurred in recent years. That's a clear sign that the planet is being overstretched. And you and I can pay a little extra for food because we spend only a small amount of our income on food. But for poor people in the developing world, food increases are very harmful. And that's why we have seen food riots in the past few years. And that might well continue.
So there are several drivers, and you've got population expansion, resource depletion, and what about energy use?
Energy is the same story. Energy increases are growing rapidly around the world, and because the price of fossil fuels hasn't gone up as much as ideal, I think the price of energy in this country, for example, should be increased by taxing carbon and or gasoline. Without price restraints, people will continue to use more energy. And the downside of that, of course, is that the greenhouse gases emission will go up and the planet warming will continue at a very rapid pace. And global warming will raise sea levels, which inundates low-lying areas in poor countries. It makes agriculture more difficult, and it increases more storms and floods. So there are many ways in which this will harm society.
Well, I'm afraid we're ending on a rather depressing note here, but this is all very real and very factual. So, what can one do?
Well, we have to look at these drivers and one by one and address them. So, I've talked about population growth, which we can reduce by investing in family planning. Avoid unplanned pregnancies, educate girls, and so on. On the consumption side, we have to recognize that what we do to the environment is unsustainable and do less of it. And the way to do less of it is to tax it or regulate it so that there will be less use of these fossil fuels. That's hard to do, and particularly in this country. Gasoline, for example, is much cheaper than in Europe or Japan, where the government taxes it. And therefore, we use much more energy per capita than in Europe or the rest of the world.
Well, John von Gotz, I thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John von Gotz, who's Vice President, Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council, where he has worked for four decades. He serves as Chairman of the Panel on Population Projections of the National Academy of Sciences at the National Research Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.